The fact that you have given me your time is to me a trust, because you had lots of things you could have done tonight. You chose to be here. And the expression of your interest to be here means that I now have a great responsibility. And my goal in this time, I want everyone who came to be glad you came. And I want you to have the desire to continue to study the book of Daniel. Really, when I do a walk through a book like this, the highest goal or the highest compliment I could hear, if it made you want to study the book more on your own. That's the best. So that's really what I'm aiming for, to try to generate some interest and excitement about this beautiful book. It's a powerful, wonderful book. And I think we'll have a good time together as we think about it. Let me just, by introduction, give you four things that I wanted to say just to open up what we're going to do here. Okay? Sorry, that's small. Four details. Four details that I want to introduce about the class. And number one is already kind of done. Pastor McAvoy has already said it, the details about the class. That's just in regards to time and so forth. This chart here is on the website, and so if you're wondering about times, you could always get on there and see it. But I don't think I have anything else to add to it. So we can go ahead and check one of those. Okay. Second thing on the list, let me introduce to you what you have in front of you. And that's this booklet that we've got here. This is just something that accumulated for me as I've taught the different classes in different places. Each time I might add something more, and it's kind of built up over time. So there are three parts that I want to show you. If you turn the after the first page, after the table of contents, the next page you'll see it says part one, and that is a study guide on the book of Daniel. What's going on here? What do I mean by study guide on the book of Daniel? Well, just this. My goal is, like I said, I want you maybe to get excited about the book or want to see more, want to study more. Let's say you finish this week and you're trying to remember some of the things that we went through. What I did here, I gave you kind of a guided way to study each chapter on your own. Okay, so if you've hit a place where in your personal Bible study you're not feeling super energized, motivated with your Bible study, great, you came to the right place tonight. After this class is done, you've got 12 chapters, and you could do one of these a day. You could do this across 2 days. So you might be looking at 24 days of your personal Bible study. It's right here, and it's kind of laid out for you. What I say at the top, read through that chapter 3 times, so you kind of get familiar with the chapter, and then it just walks you through each piece, okay? I'm just asking you different questions. I'm going somewhere with each question, but it's kind of there to help you walk through the process, okay? That's all 12 chapters, and each of those chapters is just there so that you can kind of get into studying that on your own. That's your own study. I would love it if after this class is done, someone or a lot of someones wanted to go and do that study on your own. I think from a teacher standpoint, I would say that is the best way for you to capture the book of Daniel and remember it. Because we'll spend these days going through it. If you go through it again on your own, my experience as a teacher says you'll learn the most in the process of your going on through it on your own as kind of a review of what we just did. Let me strongly commend that. Okay, part two. If you keep on moving here, you're going to get to part two. And part two is a translation and exegesis of Daniel. It's 24 pages. I can tell you that because there's 12 chapters and 2 pages each. 24 pages translation and exegesis of Daniel. All that means, big scary words, I guess. All it means is that I worked through the book and I wanted to understand for myself. And so I put in these notes to help you understand. Okay? I would encourage you maybe not to try to read this section of the book. Well, you can, feel free. If you want to, that's great. I think you'll probably struggle if you just try to read through this section. So why do I have it here? What's the point? Well, let's look at the top part. The top part, if you look at it, that's just the Bible. What I did in order to help me understand is I went through and translated myself. The first 2 chapters are Hebrew, and after that it goes to Aramaic. And I just translated through chapter by chapter myself. I don't really have here a certain philosophy. There's places where I wanted to bring out this idea that's in the Aramaic. I'm not making things up. It's all there. But maybe that you might not naturally see or something. So as you read through, that's what that is. Okay. But what I really care about, what probably would be more helpful to you, is what's underneath. Okay. So you see these footnotes underneath, start 16 and so forth. The idea of that is when you have a question, I just put in all the things that were interesting or helpful to me down there. Okay, let's say, I was looking at this today. Let's say that you were in chapter 2, and you read in this section, if we go to chapter 2, verse 24, and it says that they're going to destroy the wise men of Babylon, and you're kind of wondering, why is what's Daniel doing, what's he thinking, what's he saying there? Well, what you would do, you see a note there, it says, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon, 25. You go down to the bottom, you look at 25, and I just had a comment here. It's amazing that Daniel's first words were out of concern for the protection of his colleagues. Okay? Or, right after this, Arioch says, I have found a man from among the Judean exiles. I have a note down there that says, Arioch seems to be taking the credit. I have found the man. Okay? So, if later on in your study, you hit a verse and you're confused, what is this? I don't... Well, that's what this is for. Right? It's kind of like a commentary, if you want to put it in those terms. Or, you just turn to that place, you find that verse, you look down in the notes, and I'm trying to give you some information there. All I did there, as I went through different commentaries and things like that, I pulled out the stuff that helped me the most. Okay, so and I just collected it here. That way, you don't necessarily have to buy the commentary and get into all that detail. It's just here for you. Okay, the last section is section 3. Funny how I named it that. Last section is section 3, and it says Introduction and Theology of Daniel. All that means is in that section I'm going to talk about things like the date, I'm going to talk about the chronology, the history, the theology, meaning kind of what are the big ideas that Daniel emphasizes there. I've got a couple of more detailed discussions, who is Darius, and some of the questions there about the Antichrist, talking about Daniel 9:24-27 because it's controversial. I'll just tell you honestly straight up from the beginning, this section's kind of more academic, technical, okay? And so, if you're interested in that kind of stuff, go for it. If not, no problem, don't worry about it. And I would say the further you go in the book, that's kind of the way it works. Part 1 is really accessible. Anybody go through that study guide, no problem. Part 2, a little bit more detailed. Part 3, really detailed. So, I would say start with a study guide. If you have a question, look at part 2, see what some of those things are there. Just work through that way. Okay, that's it on the book. So, let's go back here and I can mark off my second checkbox. I'm working through the to-do list. Here's the third thing I want to say. When we say something like we're going to have a class on Daniel, class, I thought school was done. Class has an implication of academic, right? Well, I want to give you quality information. I really want to talk through in ways that are clear, helpful, understandable. I want to give you quality information during this time. I do also want to say, just because something is a study, or even if we call it a class, doesn't mean we're not allowed to get a blessing. In fact, what I want out of this time, each chapter, I want us to be really encouraged and heartened and enjoy the things that we're doing. That's my goal. I want you to enjoy what we're doing here. Enough that you love the book and you want to come back to it. One of the things that I want to do here with each chapter, if I remember, is at the end of each chapter, I'd like to ask you for yourself, based on what we just saw, what are some of the big ideas, let's say, pick out one big idea and one practical thing that you personally should do. One big idea and one practical thing you personally should do. Well, how's that going to work? What's that going to look like? Well, that was number 3. Let's go to the last thing that I wanted to do here. A brief review of Daniel chapter 1. What I'll do is I'll talk quickly through Daniel chapter 1. We already did it Sunday 2 weeks ago, I believe. And if you have not heard that yet, you can download that. That's on the Hanover HBCVA website. You can download it and listen to it. Some of you may not have been there. So I want to quickly talk through Daniel chapter 1, and then let's practice. Let's think about Daniel chapter 1. What's the big idea, and what do I need to do in response to that? Okay, so let's look at Daniel chapter 1. I'm turning up here to the section 2. And that's, or the part 2, where it says chapter 1, and I'm looking down those pages that are there. I have to move fast because our time is limited, so let's talk quickly through what we saw here. First question for those of y'all that were here, who is the hero of Daniel chapter 1? God. All right, the temptation is Daniel. What a guy. Be like Daniel. I asked this to a group of students in the Philippines. What is the point of Daniel chapter 1? And someone came up with, Daniel was courageous, be like Daniel. And we said last Sunday, well, Daniel was a courageous guy, and praise the Lord that he was, and praise the Lord that Daniel shows us a great example. And that's fine in many ways for us to look at a good example in the Bible and say, I ought to be like that guy. But the hero of the story is always God. The hero of the story is always God. Now, what do I mean by that? Let's think about it a little bit as we walk through this story. The story starts out with a crisis, doesn't it? In the very first verse, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Nebuchadnezzar takes the vessels of the house of God. He brings them to Shinar, to the house of his gods. He placed the vessels in the treasure house of his gods. And you just think about the crisis of that. The same God who guided his people out of Egypt, across the Red Sea, and this great victory over Pharaoh, the same God who led them into the promised land. They marched around Jericho and the walls fell down. The same God who gave them victory everywhere they go. And to the point that then they have the sacred temple and the sacred ark, that when that ark goes off to the Philistines, everything gets destroyed in their country until they return the ark back. When someone touches the ark, he's struck dead. That God, that holy God, where is he now? What happened to him now? Where are the victories that happened in Joshua's time? Have they vanished? Has God forgotten us? And think about all the promises. This is, Daniel comes towards the end of the Old Testament. Think about all the promises from God that he would bring about a great victory through Israel connected to the Messiah. So the Messiah will come from Israel, right? Well, it looks like Israel just got destroyed. It looks like there is no more Israel. So has God forgotten his promises? See, this is a crisis. And it's the question of, has God forgotten his people? Does he care? Does he even notice them anymore? And what we said last time was a detail that we had to notice right here, verse 2. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into his hand. God is not dead. God has not forgotten. God has not lost control. In fact, God allowed or even gave this victory into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. And if we kept on going, we find out things like this, that God gave to Daniel favor in the eyes of the eunuchs. Verse 9. God gave Daniel gracious favor and compassion. Later on, we discover that God gave them wisdom in verse 17 and understanding in all literature so that Daniel could understand all visions and dreams. And so we discover that underneath the story, actually, God is working the whole time. It's not that God has lost control. God is the hidden actor in this story. God is the one who's doing it. God is the hero of the story the whole time. God has not forgotten. God is doing something wonderful. And there was one more thing we saw last time. Do you remember this detail based off of verse 21? You have this little detail at the end. It says, and Daniel remained until the first year of Cyrus the king. Okay, so, all right, that's interesting. Cyrus, here's what I think goes on in our heads maybe when we see something like that. We think, some guy, some king. And that's sort of like an extra verse. That's sort of a verse that doesn't really matter. It's just sort of thrown in there, but there's not much point to it. So, Cyrus the king, keep on moving, right? And what we said on that last Sunday was, no, this is a big deal. Because who was Cyrus? Well, let me show you something that Cyrus did. Okay, here's something from Cyrus himself. So, when we say this Cyrus, we're not some Bible guy. Well, he's in the Bible, but he's a real historical guy. You can go to, I actually saw this myself. There's a museum in London, UK, and this rock is sitting there. Okay, and this is called the Cyrus Cylinder. And believer, unbeliever, everybody agrees, yes, this is Cyrus doing. It's a law. And if you can read that, anybody? Probably not, no? Okay. If you read that, then you would see, well, here, maybe you can read that. That's a little clearer. More helpful. If you read that, what you would find out is that Cyrus the king is saying, I'm going to send all the captives that Nebuchadnezzar took, all the people that are expats, all the foreigners that live in this city, go home. Go back to your land. And that gets kind of interesting because when you go to the book of Ezra or the book of Nehemiah, that's what those books are all about. Those books start out with saying, Cyrus the king made a decree. That decree. Cyrus the king made a decree and he sent all of the captives back to their homeland. That's what those books are all about. And not just that. Remember what I said? All the promises in the Old Testament that the Messiah will come from Israel. That the Messiah will be born in this nation of Israel. If there is no nation of Israel, no Messiah. If there is no Messiah, no Christ, no cross, no resurrection, no salvation. How do those promises get fulfilled? Cyrus is part of bringing back the nation of Israel so that there can be a Messiah, so that I can sit here in 2017 and know that my sins are forgiven. This is a big deal. Well, what's kind of interesting about that is you have these records. Okay, this is a historian, a Jewish historian from around that time. And here he's reading some prophecies in Isaiah. And this was known because he read in Isaiah, who, by the way, prophesied over 100 years before any of this, actually more like 200 years before any of this happened. He read this, and then in Isaiah it mentions that these things would happen. So, accordingly, when Cyrus read this and admired the divine power, he had this desire. So he called for, let me just highlight right here, he called for the most eminent Jews that were in Babylon and said to them that they should go back to their own country and to rebuild. Okay, so here's my question. When we think about this right here, Daniel chapter 1, verse 21, Daniel remained until the first year of Cyrus the king. We know from Daniel 1 to 6 that Daniel just got promoted and promoted and promoted until the end, Daniel chapter 6. Daniel is a very, very important person in the government, right? So would Daniel, question, based on what I just said, would Daniel be one of these eminent Jews? And the answer is yes. Do we know biblically for sure that Cyrus consulted Daniel? I won't say that. We don't know for sure. There's no place that says that. But I think when you get to the end of Daniel chapter 1, that verse 21, is there for a purpose. And it's saying to you that Daniel was there until Cyrus. And Cyrus, everybody knows this, right? Isaiah, Ezra, Nehemiah, Cyrus, big name. Big important guy, not just some king, I don't know, I probably learned him in history, forgot him since. Big deal, Cyrus. That Daniel was there until Cyrus, and during the reign of Cyrus, Daniel was in Babylon, and we have this record that it was these eminent Jews that were part of them returning back to the promised land. So our conclusion last Sunday was this. Even in a crisis, Daniel chapter 1, Israel is destroyed. Even when it looks like there is no hope, everything is gone. Even when it looks like God is not fulfilling His promises, He has not forgotten. And God still has a plan. And Daniel chapter 1 verse 21 shows you that. God put Daniel in Babylon so that he would be there at the perfect time. Prepared his way, put him right there so that, ready for this, 70 years later, Daniel would have some input in this decision and be part of the fulfillment of prophecy that meant the coming of Christ and my salvation. And can you believe then that at 14, 15 years old, Daniel, teenager, suffers a catastrophe because God has a plan for him when he's 80. When he's 80 years old, God will use Daniel in a great way. Okay, I said over here that we would do a brief review of Daniel chapter 1. We have now done our brief review of Daniel chapter 1. Here's what I want, though. I said we were going to think through this together, and I wanted us to come up with a big idea, something I need to do. Those two things. What's the big idea of Daniel chapter 1? What's a something I need to do in response to that? Now, for sake of time, what I'll do is I'll just give you what I was thinking. Okay? But on Daniel chapter 2, I'll ask you to give your own. So, what I was thinking with Daniel chapter 1 would be just what I just expressed. Even in a crisis, even in catastrophe, God still has a plan. Even in a catastrophe, God still has a plan. Now, what that would look like when I think about myself and my own life, it would run along the lines that I do not know any of God's purposes, God's grand purposes for my life, and I can't plan out my way because I don't have control of my life. God is in control of every detail. So what should I do today, as in Friday evening? What should I do? In the decisions I make, and I've got different decisions I'm thinking about right now, in the decisions I make, I have no idea where I will be when I'm 80 years old. God knows. I have no idea what I'll be doing in many cases, specific ways, a couple of weeks from now. Who knows exactly where I'll be, what I'll be doing. So I need to do this. Number one, I need to be walking with God, and I need to be trusting Him to direct my way. Right? That would be my practical conclusion. In these decisions I make, let me ask God for His help to direct my way instead of me trying to plan my path, because I have no idea. I have no clue. But God is the one who plans. 70 years ahead? No. 1,000 years ahead, and not even that. In eternity past, He has these things planned. I can trust Him. Okay, that's what I would ask you to do for Daniel chapter 2, Daniel, as we go forward, as we take each one of these. What big idea, and what do I need to do in response? All right, let's go to Daniel chapter 2. That was as fast as we could go, just because we had already covered that before. Daniel chapter 2, I have a little bit more time now to think through the story a little bit. So look down the page and kind of get an idea of what you're seeing there. When you look at Daniel chapter 2, I would say, my suggestion, there are basically four sections that are happening here in Daniel chapter 2. And those four sections would roughly be like this. First section would be the discussion between the king and the wise men. Discussion between the king and the wise men, and it's going to kind of go back and forth. Let's look at that really quickly. Starting out, Daniel chapter 2, it says, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, he dreamed dreams. And these dreams were not just any old dreams. I mean, these were very specific, particular dreams. What did he dream? He was disturbed. His sleep was gone away from him. So he calls all of his magicians and his conjurers and his sorcerers to declare to him the dream. He wants answers, what was going on. Here's what's kind of interesting about this conversation. Just notice the process here. The king says to him that he wants them to know the dream, verse 3. Okay, so king says, tell me the dream. Their answer, verse 4, we will give you an interpretation. The king answered and says, no, I want, verse 5, the dream. They answer him in verse 7, we will give you the interpretation. So there's a little back and forth here. And here's how I want to explain this or give you an idea of what's going on. They have something that they can do, and that actually people did this pretty often, apparently, historically, in this time. You see this big rock over here on the right side of the screen? Okay, that's another one of those that I don't think any of us can read. I may be wrong, but I definitely cannot read that. And what is that thing? That's a dream manual from the Babylonian era. It's a dream manual. And here's the way it worked. It kind of worked a little bit like a horoscope or something. You know how those horoscopes, whoever writes these is pretty smart, actually. Because the way they write them just right, so it's kind of ambiguous, but a little bit clear so that you actually think that happened to you that day, right? You're like, oh yeah, wow, you know, you're going to meet an important person today. Well, you're probably going to meet somebody. Somebody you'll probably meet. So yeah, that's what they do. That's the way these dream manuals worked a little bit. So the dream manual that we have in stone, right? I mean, it's a physical object. And the writing, you translate it. It'll say things like this. If the guy has a dream and there's a tree involved, then the tree probably represents, you know, I don't know, good fortune. And if there's a dream and it has clouds in it, then the clouds probably represent a future risk of catastrophe. And if there's a mountain, then it probably, and so they just give you all the symbols. So it's real easy if you're one of these Chaldean guys. You just take the dream, you kind of go through the interpretation here, right? Kind of put it into the box, and then it just tells you what each thing is, and then, O king, live forever, I have an interpretation of your dream. Easy job. So that's the way it works. The king doesn't just want the interpretation. He says, I want you to tell me the dream. It's a little bit like there was a thing that happened where these people had a belief. They said, "I above everybody's head, I see these kind of halo glow thing. And so, like, yours is kind of a blue color, and that tells me that you're in a good mood. And that yours is a little bit green color, that tells me that you're not feeling so well." And they said this. Really? Yeah, for real. Really? Yeah. Okay. So these scientists got a curtain, and they got people to stand behind the curtain, and they said, okay, to the guy on the other side, tell me where he is, because it's a long curtain. Is he there? There. Guess what? They couldn't tell, because there was no green, blue halo thing over their head. They're making it up. They're making the whole thing up. Okay. If these Chaldeans are saying that they can interpret the dream. It's really easy to make stuff up, isn't it? Tell me your dream. There was a tree. Great, I can tell you what trees mean, and I can do that. But what if the guy comes to you and you have to tell him what the dream was? Ooh, there you have to be real. There you actually have to be able to tell the truth, because you can't make it up. Here's one thing I want to clarify here, because this is sometimes a little bit of a confusion. In verse 5, one way to interpret this is to say, the thing is gone from me. That's one possible wording in verse 5. The thing is gone from me. And so I used to assume that Nebuchadnezzar forgot the dream. In other words, he dreamed the dream, he wakes up, and you have this happen. I had a dream. Oh, it was a crazy dream. I can't remember it. I already forgot it. Right? I used to assume that Nebuchadnezzar forgot it. The thing is gone from me. Actually, what that expression means, it's more like, I have already written the decree and signed it. In other words, the thing is gone from me. The law is out of my hands. I've already said what I'm going to do. I've already signed the decree. Meaning, I would suggest, most likely, Nebuchadnezzar had not forgotten the dream. He still remembers the dream. So what he's thinking is something like this. I'll come in, I'll ask them the dream. If they, you know, they can interpret dreams all these years, they've done that for me. But if they can tell me what I dreamed, now I know they're for real. Now I know it's true, right? That's a way I can test whether they're for real or not. And that's probably part of his urgency with this, possibly even suspicion. I always want, if you kind of go through this cycle, it makes me laugh every time I read this story. Watch these, I call them cycles of the conversation. So the king comes to them first, tell me the dream. Their response, this is very clear if you look, dream versus interpretation. Their response, oh sure, tell us the dream, we'll interpret. You tell us the dream, we'll tell you what it means. He comes back. No, tell me the dream, let me make this a little clear. Tell me the dream or I'll kill you. Is that a little clear? I think that's clear now. Any questions? Okay, sure, no problem. Tell us the dream and we'll interpret. You're not listening, are you? No, actually they're listening very well. Cycle 3. You're lying. You're wasting my time. Okay, he knows that. And he says that. I mean, you look at the way his wording, verse 8, I know with certainty you are trying to gain time because you see from me that the matter is firm. And their answer here, I want you to pay attention to this. You need to pay attention to this. Big deal. Their answer right after this tells you actually pretty good theology or pretty good understanding that's happening. Verse 10, let's read it. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man upon the earth who is able to declare the king's matter. There is therefore no king, great man, or ruler who asks this type of thing of any magician or conjurer or Chaldean. The matter which the king is asking is difficult. And basically, their argument is, this is not the normal job requirement. Right? I mean, you're just supposed to give us dreams, and we interpret dreams. But when we have to tell you the dream, too, that's not fair. Right? I mean, this is not within our normal. Kings shouldn't do this. This is not normal. And listen to these words. There is none other who can declare it before the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Cycle 3, nobody can do this except maybe the gods. And the assumption of that, whose dwelling is not with flesh, the idea is only the gods know this kind of stuff and we don't know them. The gods up there in some other place and we don't have access to them, they know this kind of stuff, but how are we supposed to talk to the gods? We don't have contact with them. That's pretty important because of what comes next. Daniel receives this news about what had gone on. And when Daniel hears the news, verse 17, let's just look at the response. Verse 17, Daniel went to his house and he made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his friends, he told them to seek compassion from before the God of heaven concerning this mystery. The wise men, their response is, only the gods know this stuff and we have no access to them. Daniel's response is, yes, I agree. Not the gods, but only God knows this stuff. And I have a relationship with him and I can pray. His response is to access the God who knows this stuff. In total contrast to the pagans who say, only the gods know and we have no contact with them. Now, I have to just quickly answer one question that maybe has come up when you're looking at this chapter. Okay, if you notice the way that this went, I skipped over it. In verse 12, the king was very angry, he was furious, and he said he was going to destroy all the wise men in Babylon. So verse 13, the decree went out that all the wise men would be slain. They sought Daniel and his friends to slay them. Then Daniel apparently receives this messenger, verse 14, Arioch, coming to him. And his question is, why is this decree so harsh from before the king? Think about it a little bit. Daniel apparently has not heard about the decree. Right? Apparently the decree was made. Daniel receives a messenger. The guy comes to his door. In fact, this word, the way that he's described, this Arioch, the leader of the king's guard, there's a possibility, maybe probability, that that word actually refers to the executioner. Okay? Like this is the guy who goes around and does this stuff, kills people. So he's showing up at Daniel's door. Daniel opens the door. Oh, hi. What are you doing here? Well, good afternoon. Hope you're well. I've come to kill you. And that's the way that this conversation opens up. So Daniel's next response is, really? Why? Can you give me some background maybe before I die? Okay. And that seems to be the flow of thought here, at least that Daniel is very close to being. I mean, apparently it seems that they are going around already and doing these executions. But the question you might ask is, how is it that Daniel is part of the wise men, so he gets killed, but he doesn't know anything about the conversation? That makes sense. I mean, in other words, if you've got a group of guys, these wise men, these counselors, and the king tests them and they fail, so the king says, we're killing all of you. You would assume that Daniel at least should have the right to be part of the group if he has to die. Right? It's like he's not in the first group, he's not even there, because apparently he knows nothing about it. But he is in the second group, the group of people that has to die. And what's going on there? Okay, here's an interesting detail about the chapter. Look back at the beginning of the chapter, chapter 2, verse 1. Chapter 2, verse 1 says, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. It's another one of those verses, right? We read over it like, oh, some king, some year, who cares? I don't know that history stuff anyway. Well, it's there for a reason, because go back to chapter 1, and in chapter 1, verse 1, you read that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up to Jerusalem and besieged it, telling you chapter 1 happened when Nebuchadnezzar was already king, right? And chapter 2 is happening in the second year of his reign. One more detail. Look back at chapter 1, verse 5. Verse 5 tells us that they were to be taken care of for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. So their education would last for 3 years. Okay, chapter 1, Nebuchadnezzar was already king. He came and conquered Babylon. They're going to study for 3 years, but when I get to chapter 2, verse 1, this is only the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Everything's easier with graphics, so let's try it that way. Okay, their education is going to last for, we just said, 3 years. Okay, so we got that. Chapter 2 happens in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, which tells you, putting these things together, what's happening in chapter 2 is actually in the middle of chapter 1. Okay, that's why I've got it set up that way. Over here, this is Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. This is the end of Daniel 1, where the king interviewed them and he found that they were wise. Well, everything we're reading here is happening in the middle, during this process, while this is going on. What does that tell you, and why do I go into that much detail? Because of this. Apparently, Daniel is still a student. In a 3-year program, he's a sophomore. Okay, so he's got another year before he graduates. He's a sophomore. And when they call all the wise men of Babylon in before the king, they call in all the teachers, all the professors, all the established people, all the truly wise men, in their minds anyway. But this student, he's not even graduated. He's a sophomore, right? Don't call sophomores. Let's just bring in the wise men. And the assumption is you bring in the wise men, and if they can't answer the question, the sophomore doesn't have a chance, right? I mean, if the PhDs and the experts, the teachers of his classes, if you want to put it in those terms, if his teachers can't answer the question, the student doesn't have a chance. But when Nebuchadnezzar rolls out the decree to kill all the wise men of Babylon, he includes Daniel. Daniel's in the group. He's one. Why? Well, he's studying to be a wise man. Close enough. Right? And what that tells you, it's very interesting. These people, the wise men, the Chaldeans, they did not view Daniel with enough significance, respect, to even call him out. For him even to have a chance to testify before the king. They don't view him with that much significance. If he dies, he dies. He doesn't have a chance. We're the teachers. Let's look at Daniel's response when Daniel receives this vision right away. Daniel goes, verse 24, and his immediate response to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He came and spoke thus to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon." Probably the idea is, stop killing the wise men. And he rushes, right? He rushes in before Arioch. Stop doing it. I have an answer. And there's an interesting irony in here. The very people who did not care at all about Daniel to even call him out and give him a chance to answer, they are the people that Daniel ends up saving by being able to give an answer. Now, when I did that, I skipped over the second section of this story. And I need us to look at it now. So I'm going to read it because we need to read it. This is, I would say, the most important part of the whole story. I say that for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's right in the middle. Number two, it's a poem. And you don't necessarily see that in our English form. But the way it's written in Aramaic, this is the only section of the chapter that's a poem. And the way it's all set up here in the middle of the chapter highlights it, that this section is really important. It's a prayer from Daniel, so I'll start reading in verse 19. In a vision at night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel. And Daniel blessed the God of heaven. And Daniel answered and said, "May the name of God be blessed from ever and to forever." Okay, it's from eternity past to eternity future is kind of the idea. "Because wisdom and power belong to him. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who know understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness and light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise. For wisdom and might you have given to me. And now you have made known to me what we sought from you, because the king's matter you have made known to us." Okay. We're going to do a little bit of analysis to try to understand what's going on in this poem. Okay, look at what we've got up here. Let's try to analyze what's there. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever. And at the end of that poem, at the very end, he's doing the same thing again. He's giving praise to God who has blessed him and given him these answers. I want you to notice two words that get repeated at the beginning and at the end of the poem. Do you see what they are? There are the words right here, "To him belong wisdom and might." And at the end of the poem, "He has given me wisdom and might." Okay, so you see that? So those ideas are important, apparently, because Daniel has highlighted beginning and end. That's a poetry thing, right? You put an idea at the beginning, you put an idea at the end, and that kind of tells you wisdom and might is a big deal. Okay, now, once you take those wisdom and might ideas, now I want you to notice, that's the introduction, that's the conclusion, everything in the middle is either talking about wisdom or might. The whole section in the middle discusses wisdom and might. Let me show you. All the words in red, wisdom. He gives wisdom to the wise, knowledge, understanding, reveals, knows, light dwells with him. Wisdom and might you have made known to me, you have made known to us. So what's that? That's wisdom. Basically say this, God knows everything, right? Fair enough. Color blue, it's a little dim, I'm sorry. Up at the top, wisdom and might. Well, how do I see God's power? God can do anything. We'll say it that way. How do I see that God can do anything? Well, God changes times and seasons. God removes kings and sets up kings. He's in charge. He's in charge of the world. So that what this poem is telling me, or this story is telling me, God knows everything, and God can do everything. Put it in theology words, God is omniscient, and God is omnipotent. Put it in other words, God has all knowledge and all power. Or, in the words of this poem right here, he has all wisdom and might. Now, that's important. Because that tells me the rest of the story. That explains what's going on in this whole thing. Think about it up to this point. Remember the Chaldeans and their question. We can't answer your question. The king says, tell me the dream. We'll give you interpretation. Tell me the dream. Interpretation? Dream. Interpretation? Okay, I'll kill you. We can't answer because only the gods know that stuff and we don't know them. Right? That's their response. Daniel goes to the true God, and God does know this stuff. God can tell you every thought, word, or dream that ever passed through the mind of Nebuchadnezzar, and God can reveal it. And it's because to him belongs all wisdom. He knows everything. As you keep on going through the story, the last story of the section, Daniel is going to give that information to the king. So he goes in before the king. The king wants to know verse 26. Another thing that just kind of makes me laugh. Are you able to make known the dream which I saw and its interpretation? The king is very clear because he went through three cycles of this. Tell me the dream and its interpretation. How about the interpretation? No, the dream and its interpretation. How about the interpretation? No, the dream and its... So as soon as Daniel comes up before him, this is kind of the effect it gives you. Nebuchadnezzar thinking, oh, brother, okay, here we go again. Another guy thinks that he can save his scrawny neck by coming in here and trying to pull the wool over my eyes. Again, are you able to make known to me the dream, and the interpretation? All right, here we go. And Daniel answers before the king, verse 27, just to be clear. Let's review. The mystery which the king asked, none of your wise guys were able to interpret. Remember that? Yeah, everybody remembers that. They've been dying for it. Okay, but verse 28, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. They said, gods, and we don't have access to them. Daniel says, there is a God, and he does have access to this information, and he does reveal. He does speak truth. Not just a God in some distant place, but a God who gives truth to people, who will just ask people who will turn to him. So this revelation then, I will tell you what God has made known. And Daniel's going to do this one more time. Later on at the end of the chapter, Daniel will repeat this again just to make it clear. This is not me, and it's not because I have wisdom that I'm interpreting this. But verse 45, a great God has made known to the king what will be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation to be trusted. So I say all that to say, definitively, I hope we can agree, it's very clear in this chapter that this chapter emphasizes God knows everything. God reveals dreams. God reveals stuff that nobody else can have access to. Okay, question. There's not one thing up there. There are two things, right? It's a God of wisdom and might. So the one thing was wisdom. We agreed with that. We just saw it. I just talked through it. God knows everything. And so God is able to interpret, or God is able to reveal the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. My question is, why does it say wisdom and might? What's the might thing all about? Where do I see the idea of power or of might in this chapter? Okay, so let me give you a second or two. Look down through the chapter. I'll give you a hint. It's going to be in this last part. Okay? It's going to be verse 31 on down that we're going to see this idea of might, that God has all power. Where would I find that in the chapter? Great. Okay, he says, the stone because it destroys the statue. Let's roll that backwards now. Well, if it destroys the statue, what's the big deal about the statue? What is the statue? The statue seems to be picturing the kingdoms of men. And how do I know that? Well, you see, Daniel gives him what the dream was. And then verse 37, I'll give you the interpretation. You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom God has given the kingdom and the power and the might and the glory. And you yourself are the head of gold on this statue. You're the head. Okay, the rest of the statue, verse 39, after you there will arise another kingdom inferior to you, another third kingdom which will rule over all the earth. There will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron that crushes and scatters all these things. These are all the kingdoms of the world that are coming forward in history. Now, I think we can get this idea. If you think about in the progression of history, we live in a particular time in human history where the United States is very predominant. And there was just a thing that happened where they were taking the picture for the NATO summit that they just had, and they said that the President of the United States should be in front, you know, because of whatever influence that the U.S. has worldwide. Well, before the U.S. became that way, there were other countries that were more influential. Probably we'd say something like the UK. And before the UK, it was probably Spain. And you can just walk backwards and you see this kind of sequence of different kingdoms. One kingdom becomes predominant, conquers another, and then the next conquers, and so on and so forth. You go forward. Okay, so you have that idea. What does that imply? That implies that the greatest power on planet Earth will eventually fade. The greatest power at a given time, it's just temporary. You can have a country with aircraft carriers and jet planes and everything else that they put together, and all the power and the accumulation of influence and resources and everything, it's going to fade away. Some other country's going to come along and eat our lunch. It's just what's going to happen. Because all the power and authority of human beings is nothing. It ultimately fails. It ultimately gets replaced. And exactly what Jeff said, most significantly, in the end, it all gets crushed. Because you have this next part. In the days, verse 44, of those kings, the God of heaven will raise up a kingdom which will not be destroyed forever. It will not be left to another people. It will pulverize and conclude all these kingdoms. It will stand forever. Here's the idea that Daniel is telling the king. Nebuchadnezzar, you're the greatest and most powerful ruler of your day. Good for you. It's almost kind of a way to go. You're a very powerful ruler, so, okay. You'll be replaced. And actually, don't worry about it too much, because there will be a replacement for the replacement, and there will be a replacement for the replacement for the replacement for you. So, everybody gets replaced. It's just a matter of time. But what you need to know is that ultimately all human authority gets crushed, crumbles, and is turned to dust in the face of the authority of God Almighty. He is the King of Kings. He changes times and seasons. He defines the epochs. He defines the eras of history. And he removes kings and he sets up kings. That any king who has ever been in a powerful position on planet Earth, he is only there because God picked him up like a chess piece and put him in that position. And God can just as easily reach in, pick up that same chess piece, and he's gone. Just like that. God sets up kings, removes kings, and human authority, it's just part of God's plan. He puts the people in place that he wants to be there, according to his decision. Nebuchadnezzar, you just need to know, you will be replaced. But there is a kingdom coming that will never end. Now, I like what Jeff Early said when he said the stone. When you look at that stone, and I don't have time to really go a lot into it, this is a stone that was cut without human hands. Okay, and there's a note, or actually I added that today so it wouldn't be printed here. But there are some connections when you go across to the New Testament about Jesus Christ being the stone. And there are some connections with the temple made not with hands in the New Testament. And there are some links that Jesus himself says that there will be a stone and all of the kingdoms of this earth will be crushed under its power. And it's connected into the kingdom of God and God's purposes. When we're talking about this stone made not with hands, we're talking about the kingdom of God and ultimately the King himself, Jesus Christ, ruling in that kingdom. We're talking about things that stretch way up into the New Testament. And all of that's right there to say this. Don't ever have any confidence in human authority and power. God sets up kings. God removes kings. And you want to see real power? You want to see real authority, kingdom of God. Forever and ever, it will not end. There is no replacement for that king. That king rules forever, and he will never be replaced. So, when I get done with a chapter, I realize these two ideas, God knows everything, and God is in charge of everything, define the entire chapter. I would encourage you, as we think about this dream and then the interpretation, sometimes we kind of get into the head of gold and then the chest and then the legs and the feet, and we want to interpret all those different pieces, which actually we'll talk about later. I'm going to save it, but we'll come to it in chapter 7. So we'll talk about it. And sometimes then we even get into these little details where, you know, verse 41, there are feet and toes. And so we're saying, how many toes are there? Well, I don't know about you, but I have 10. Okay, and so then you can go into Revelation, and there's a thing about 10 kings, and so people start making links from the 10 toes, because most people have 10 toes, and so on and so forth. And so we can get really into these kinds of details, and I think in doing that, you miss the point of the chapter. The point of the chapter should make you, when you get to those verses, verse 44 and verse 45, when you get to the part about the stone coming out from a mountain and it pulverizing the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, and it will be a kingdom which will not be destroyed forever, that should make you go, woohoo! Because that's the great victory of Jesus Christ over all the kingdoms of this earth. All the kingdoms of this earth will fade, and not just that, be destroyed. Turn to dust. Turn to just nothingness under the reign of Jesus Christ in a kingdom that will never end. That's the point of the chapter. That's the beauty of the chapter. And you and I then ought to rejoice in the confidence of our God who knows all things and our God who has all power. Okay, I have just enough time. Take, well, say 3 minutes, because that's what I've got, to write down how would you summarize the big idea of this chapter? And then I really want this to be practical. What is something I need to do in response to this? Something practical that I need to do. Big idea of the chapter and something I should do in response. Take 2 or 3 minutes. Let's put something down for each chapter so that as we go through, these chapters register with us and we're doing something with what we just heard. Okay, so what those two things are for me, I have access to a God who knows everything and can do anything. Why would I turn anywhere else? Right. If you knew somebody who was in the high reaches of the government and then you had a need, you'd go to him, right? I know somebody who has all knowledge and all power. So practical for me, I'm thinking of a very specific decision in my life that I need to make. And so my God knows exactly all the details of that decision, and my God can intervene to make that work. So how should I respond tonight? I should pray to him. I should ask him to help, right? Why go to anybody else or anywhere else? I have a God who knows everything and can do anything. That's who I should go to, of course. And that would be the practical response that I personally would want to make. Okay, I'm going to pose to you a question, and then we will take our break. In chapter 3, it's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? And it's the fiery furnace. Question: why isn't Daniel there? Where's Daniel? If you watch the Bible documentary series that was really popular, the History Channel put out, if you watch their section on this, Daniel is there. And Daniel is saying to his three friends, no, just bow down. Just bow down. Okay, so I don't believe that. Why isn't Daniel in chapter 3? Well, the clue is actually in chapter 2, why Daniel wasn't there. That's all I'll say.